This is recorded on the morning of July the 11th, 1972, an interview for the Purdue University Archives between President Emeritus Frederick L. Hovde and R.B. Eccles in the Department of History. President Hovde, we are talking yesterday about new problems and the change after the World War II in the nature of the university's educational services.
Following the GI bulge, which terminated about 1949-50, the university returned to its normal student status with high school graduate input as freshmen, normal kind of transfers from other colleges and universities, and the entry of graduate students. And during the 50s and decades of the 50s and 60s, the professional schools of the university continued to grow, especially at the graduate level. In fact, the principal change that occurred in the university's educational services to its clientele was in the growth of the graduate school of the university. Growth in graduate enrollment, during this period also plans were made for the introduction of several new professional schools and curricula. School of Veterinary Medicine was established after the issue had been debated in three successive legislative sessions. School of Veterinary Medicine, as one of the new professional schools that was established in my tenure, was an interesting history. There was general support for the establishment of the School of Veterinary Medicine, even though the profession itself was somewhat divided. A good many members of the practicing profession were, of course, fearful that if a school were established, the incoming new professionals would be a threat to their livelihoods. But studies showed that just to keep even with maybe a small additional plus, keep even in the sense of replacing retirees, those who died, School of Veterinary Medicine graduating 50 to 60 students per year would just keep the balance even, maybe with a little plus. Not significant, really. The legislature was willing to start a school, but of course wanted to do it without adequate appropriations. We insisted, I insisted from the beginning, that if the school was to be established, it was to be financed first in terms of the plant required, the physical plant required, second in terms of the operating costs for a fully accredited professional first-class School of Veterinary Medicine. And every proposal to authorize the establishment of the school on a shoestring without adequate support was turned down by the university and myself. Finally, in the administration of Governor Handley, a bill was passed establishing the school and providing capital grant to build a full-fledged school, which was designed and based upon best practice that had been we could observe in the formation of some 10 new veterinary schools throughout the country prior to that, the time of the establishment of Purdue School of Veterinary Medicine. And from the very start, the school, from its opening day for the admission of its first 50 students, was a full-fledged school with complete facilities. We had had an example at the University of Minnesota where the legislature and the university started the School of Veterinary Medicine at Minnesota and built only half the facilities required. And 10 years later, the second half had not even been started yet. After the, when the first class at Purdue was seniors, ready for graduation, the school was accredited by the American Veterinary Medical Association. First case in history where the school was accredited before its first class was graduated. And of course, the school has had an outstanding record since. The School of Industrial Management, with its accompanying graduate program, known as the Krannert Graduate School of Industrial Administration, came into being because there was a clear-cut need during the decade of the 50s, clear-cut need was becoming apparent that the management of scientific research sources, particularly in the management of money and capital and scientific science and technology in the economic scene, particularly with reference to industrial production and increasing industrial proficiency and productivity, required an industrial manager trained in mathematics, sciences, the use of the computer, and the capability of exercising all the skills of management in the scientific scene. The ordinary business school, which had flourished throughout the country in many colleges and universities, was primarily directed to the management of the service industries. But School of Industrial Management was directed to the management of men and machines and capital producing all the things that we need and want as a people. And again, with good management on the part of Dean Wyler and his colleagues.
May I ask you a question that's always bothered me, interrupted at this point? Not bothered me, but was Wyler brought over here with the idea of heading an economics department? Or was there in the minds of those who brought him over the idea that he would organize and work in a school that was both engineering and economics?
No, when Wyler originally came, he came to head economics. We had an old department that was a joint one, the Department of History, Government, and Economics.
I was there.
And that was split up into History Department, Political Science Department, Economics Department. Economics, instruction in economics, of course, was a very important aspect of the general training, and general education, professional education of many of our professional students at the university, and indeed in agriculture, the economics teaching was so important that it had their own department of agricultural economics, which was a distinguished department.
Still is.
Has been for many years. The Wyler came at a particularly happy time for Purdue. It was following the death of Purdue's great teacher, Martin Esty.
J.A.S.T., you mean?
I mean J.A.S.T. Martin was his son.
His son, yes.
In retrospect, in 10 years' time, Purdue School of Industrial Management advanced from an infant to one of the 10 best schools of its kind in the world. And this pace of development is as fast as it can be done. You can't,
that is, there's no
you
question
can't do
about
it any
there.
Faster.
No question about that. Particularly
and there were, was a great deal of educational opportunity provided by that structure, because with the advent of the arts degree, by giving the Bachelor of Arts degree, which didn't come until, I've forgotten the date now, but it must have been the late 50s, early 60s even, late 50s maybe. You can check that date. Students who were interested in business careers were all practically three levels, actually. There was the possibility of a Bachelor of Arts degree with a major in economics. There was the Bachelor of Industrial Administration. And then there were the very, very ablest of students who could take the, there was a Bachelor of Industrial Economics. And then there was a Bachelor's degree in Industrial Management. Very ablest then went on, of course, to take graduate work in the Krannert School, a master's program. One of the requirements for entry into the Krannert master's program was that the candidates should have a Bachelor of Science or Arts degree with a competence in some field of science or technology. They had to have engineering or agriculture or chemistry or mathematics, or one of the competence in science and technology, and certainly an advanced university level competency in mathematics to handle quantitative economics and to develop a complete understanding of the management of computers, management and use of computers. But that development story was a fabulous story. It's the whole field of adult education was becoming more and more important through this decade, because most of the larger industries were supporting programs for upgrading their personnel. Every professional school, indeed every department of the university, had its professional clientele that were interested in that particular subject matter, the training of professionals in those subject matters. This became an important expansion of university educational services. As with the growth of the graduate school and the tremendous growth in the science departments, one of the great developments at Purdue was that of the biological sciences. When I came to Purdue, the biological Department of Biological Sciences was pretty much in the doldrums. Professor Carling was persuaded to come from Columbia to start the process of development, which he did most ably. Then he was followed by Henry Kofler, who built the Biological Sciences Department into one of the very, very best of its kind in the world. As I told Carling when he came to Purdue, that the first half of the 20th century belonged to the physicists, the chemists, and the mathematicians. The second half belonged to the biological scientists. And this intrigued him. The science departments, of course, were eventually consolidated under the leadership of Dean Haas. The Department of Physics, Department of Chemistry, Department of Mathematics, Department of Biological Sciences, and now more recently, the Department of Geosciences.
That's the newest on the campus.
The newest
science.
Science. represents in this small town the largest daily instructional load in basic sciences of any place in the world, as far as we can determine.
It's amazing.
So the sheer management problem of the instructional aspect of Purdue's work in basic sciences is a complicated monster, which operates with an efficiency that approaches the miraculous. The mathematics department is one of the largest in the world, simply because almost every degree given by Purdue, with the exception of a few Bachelor of Arts degrees, requires a good deal of instruction in collegiate level mathematics.
Do you feel like you could talk about the reason why the old school of science was split up as it was? Was it because of the introduction of new sciences?
Well, it became such a large and heterogeneous combination of departments that there was virtue in from the management point of splitting and putting people of like minds and like professional interests together. Because you had a situation in the old setup Well, you had internecine warfare.
That's a mild term for it.
Yeah. And the job was difficult enough, and the demands great enough, and the needs great enough to warrant everybody's pitching in and helping rather than bitching and fighting.
Absolutely correct. I remember it. It was a most unfortunate situation. And of course, out of this came the School of Humanities and Social Sciences, that it was the residue or remainder, in a sense. When you took the sciences
right,
and math
there was
away.
There was a growth, of course, in all the departments. There was growth in humanities and growth in the social science department, too. And the split up of the history, government, and economics department was illustrative. Those instructional programs at Purdue in those days were all in one department. The historians and the political scientists and the economists were all in one department.
And the instruction, the number, sheer weight of courses made it impossible to give a higher level or to develop specialties. It was a very difficult situation. I think the change that was separation in the three departments was not only desirable, but I think it's been
beneficial.
Well,
you see, the development of industrial management grew out of that separation, too. And that was a major step forward in the
Yes, I remember the anger
services.
That my friends in the Indiana Business School had when industrial management came. They just didn't like it at all.
But well, there was a conscious attempt on our part not to developing something with objectives that were basically different from the Indiana Business School. We could do things here in quantitative economics and industrial management primarily directed to the manufacturing industry.
Right.
As we had done for agriculture, you see, through the ag economics work. And that was a There were three schools in the country that had this particular drive and objective. There was the Sloan School at MIT and the school at Carnegie Tech. And of course, MIT and Carnegie Tech were scientific institutions just as Purdue was. So MIT, Carnegie Tech, and Purdue sort of led the way in industrial management, development of industrial management, both undergraduate and graduate programs. The educational service of Purdue to the people that is represented by the Agricultural Cooperative Extension Service underwent changes over the past two decades with the advent of scientific agriculture, tremendous increase in agricultural productivity through a broad-scale scientific attack on every phase of that productive process, producing the food and fiber. The audience had become the students of the Cooperative Extension Service who are the practicing farmers in the food industry. Well, the farmers at one part, only one part of the food industry is the storage, the processing, and all the manufacturing aspects of the food industry that go along with the farmer as part of that chain from the seed to food on your table. the county agent, who for a number of decades had served as a county advisor to the farmers, served as the channel for the communication of farm management, farm science information to the user, had finally been accepted completely by the farmer user, the rural user, and one simple little illustration will show the difference. School of Agriculture, of course, has a tremendous research program. The first intimation that one of their research programs would be fruitful with respect to any crop, there would be 500 farmers clamoring to get the information. They wanted it before the school was ready to release it, because a great many initial experimental results had to undergo a good many years of further experimentation before you were absolutely sure of what you had. The interest in this was tremendous on the part of the user.
The thing that has always impressed me as a farm boy from Nebraska is the fact that the agricultural college here, the agricultural school, knows every farmer in the state and is concerned with his problems, and he feels that he can come to that. We never had that in Nebraska, despite the fact that it was an agricultural community. I would guess that because of Purdue, the Indiana farmer is as well educated in science.
Well, I think the Indiana farmer, as a businessman and as a farmer, has probably reached as high a level of agricultural sophistication as any group of operating farmers in any state or country of the world.
I would think that.
You have a high sophistication in this respect in countries like Denmark and Holland, where the amount of land is available for agricultural production is incredibly small, and its use has to be maximized. In some fields, the Danes and the Dutch are acknowledged to be the world's best. But the situation they were faced with very early in the game demanded this kind of development towards efficient production. Necessity was the mother of invention.
But we certainly do have a very close and apparently smoothly operating tie between Purdue's agricultural department and the farmers.
Well,
state.
That's right.
It's a friendly one, too.
That's right.
Very friendly.
Friendly and a proud, has a long and proud history. And of course, the agriculturalists can cite many examples where they've pitched in times of crisis and have done valiant work to prevent agricultural catastrophe, one kind or another. Development of new varieties of corn and soybeans and wheat and oats, grasses. The department has had a long record of contribution to the economic welfare of the Indiana farmer.
Right now to the United States through Mr. Butts and Don Parlberg and others of our department.
Well, they've been great individuals who've served Purdue in the ag schools. Agricultural combine or complex, going back to the late great Harry Reed, who was dean when I came. most remarkable man, one of Purdue's first county agents way back in the days before World War I. Harry Reid was a great leader, great fighter for agriculture and the agricultural complex of Purdue. He was a great administrator in the sense that he sought, actively sought, and brought to his staff the brightest possible people he could find. He personally was never afraid of a bright man. In fact, he wanted them brighter than he was. An interesting aspect of the man.
That in itself is an unusual characteristic of an administrator.
Oh, I think the nicest recognition of the strides made by Purdue University in its professional schools and in its graduate school work and its science departments was the election of Purdue to the membership in the AAU, the American Association of Universities. Year 1955 or 56. Purdue
we were not
was the
member before that.
No, Purdue. See, the AAU, as an organization, consists of about 40 American universities, 20 private and 20 public. The division is about even. And two Canadian members that are not full-fledged members, but attend its meetings.
Associates.
The 20 private, of course, begin with Harvard. Most of the Ivy League schools, plus Chicago, Caltech, Stanford, our best universities by reputation. And the 20 leading public institutions that are members were the large state universities with great reputations like Berkeley, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Iowa, Purdue was the first separated land-grant institution to be elected.
Well, that is a distinguished honor.
And this was a recognition of the quality of the graduate work of the institution, because the graduate work was really the criterion by which the AAU elected its new members. Well,
was there any particular problem that you had in keeping all these balls going in the air at the same time, aside from losing sleep and hard work? But was there any administrative problem in developing this that was more difficult than any other single one?
Well, no, but the well-run university has to have distinguished financial management. The first half of my tenure, I had famous R.B. Stewart, who by any measures was one of the four or five best university financial men in the country. And then the second half, Mr. Freehaper, whose ability and this field is unquestionably tremendous. Purdue's business management and the management of its dollars has simply been outstanding the past 25 years. And of course, from my point of view, this is the greatest protection to the faculty of the university and the program of the university. And whenever faculty complained about the strictness and insistence upon good financial management, as they did oftentimes, I simply never listened to them because they didn't know what they were talking about in terms of
the
reputation of the university and its ability to get its job done.
Of course, I always regretted the smallness of my check. But I had been in a place where the faculty would not be paid for 3 months running.
Well, we never had to go.
State university.
We never had
you never
to go
did that.
No. We've had a financial integrity that's been basic in the management of this university. And we've never had a financial scandal of any kind. One or two minor thefts.
But nothing.
That's a human.
Yes.
Individual human failure.
No, you haven't had it.
Yeah.
And one of the things that always amazed me was that after my experience in this other state university in another state, was the lack of apparent political maneuvering on the state level. In this other university, the administration was of one political party, but the state treasurer was of another. And you see what would happen if there would be one penny off, the checks would be held up until a virtuous rectification took place. It was just that petty.
Well,
we've never had that
Purdue,
here in my experience.
Higher institutions, state institutions of higher education in Indiana were blessed for many years in the sense that they were left to manage their own affairs. This fact placed a high degree of responsibility upon the trustees and the administration to manage their affairs well. Because the moment someone mismanaged the affairs, then you had resulting controls imposed upon the system by the state legislature. And this was never more vividly illustrated than when Indiana University operated in the red, some $2 million at one particular biennium. And while the subsequent legislature bailed them out, controls were put on all four state institutions as a result of financial mismanagement at IU. At that particular time, the appropriations to IU and Purdue were the same, were always identical. And in the subsequent, when we learned of this $2 million overdraft, I approached the next legislature and said that they were going to give IU $2 more. We also should have the $2 too on the equal treatment theory, which has been in effect for many years. Well, they refused to do that, but they gave us $700,000 more that biennium than they gave IU. But this led to those long years of work between Purdue and IU and the two state teachers' colleges, which later became state universities, and the development of a formula approach to the support of the higher education. And this particular work extended over a number of years and eventually resulted in the four state institutions agreeing on division of the appropriation, how the appropriation for higher education should be divided.
When did this take place?
Well, this was work done all during the 50s. And then for a good many years we collaborated in our financial requests with a great deal of success, because we weren't fighting with each other. We were all supporting each other, because four institutions had worked out methodologies whereby if X number of dollars was being appropriated, total appropriation would be divided in a ratio. So much to IU, so much to Purdue, so much to each of the two state teachers' colleges. And if this state appropriation were reduced in total, everybody took the reduction in ratio.
That seems sensible.
This worked beautifully, this formula approach, until the Brannigan administration. Brannigan didn't like this appropriation, this collaboration, this way of doing business, preventing the four institutions from fighting with each other, and said that the institution should receive appropriations based on programs, the so-called programmatic approach, that each institution should submit its budget request to support its programs of teaching, research, and public service. So we went through the long process of submitting detailed programs, department by department, school by school, and university. All this produced great volumes of material, all submitted to the budget committee 6 months before the General Assembly was to meet. But the budget, state budget director and his staff had no one to read all this, had no one to examine the program, that no one could even understand the words that were used, particularly with reference to the research programs of the university. And so in the Brannigan administration, we reverted to the each institution on its own. Four institutions also worked together on their building program. We created a 10-year building program along about 1950. And we achieved that 10-year building program in 12 years.
That's unusual.
Which is a damn near record.
Yes, it is.
Then we started a second 10-year building program, which all the institutions had their input and their programs, and we all agreed on how this was to be. The capital appropriations were to be divided. So. This was useful development work in the management of state systems, because every state super board of regents faces the same problem, same set of problems. For the state system. One, what is to be taught in each state institution? In other words, the mission problem. Who is to do what? Second problem is, how do you then divide the money for the support of the missions? Some educational missions cost more per graduate or per any unit. Measurement.
I should think science students would cost more because of the laboratory expense and attendant expenses
well,
of that
exactly.
nature.
And of course engineering costs a lot, and so does medicine. Medicine is probably the most expensive. Mm-hmm. Cheapest probably history students.
If you would spend the money to do what universities that teach history does, you're right. But until you can give them the materials with which to work, they're apt to be expensive. But that's just a matter of meeting the needs of the sources. Yes, I agree with you.
Well, the laboratory for the historian is the library. And of course, you can sink enormous sums in library materials. And there are great libraries in the world. It's nice to have collections of materials. But collections which are unused are a waste of money.
I thought you were going to say the most expensive thing about it is the storage problem, which can be solved.
Well, no, the use problem I'm interested in. The use problem is easy. Storage problem is easy. But the use problem is the problem for the librarian, and of course modern technology now does this. Any professor at Purdue University can have any book he wants within 24 hours.
Now, I wish I found that true. You mean purchasing the book?
No, access to it. Hell, the professors don't buy books.
You're wrong there, Dan, because I know what my book bill is.
Oh, yes, for your personal library, but not for your research.
Well, no.
No, you go to collections. And you go.
Yeah. I'm going to England this fall.
Well, all right.
That's
you
an
don't
example.
Buy your research materials.
You can't.
No, you can't in the first place. They're not for sale. The books you read and you want for your private library, it's on another thing.
But the I'm an advocate of saving millions of dollars by using microform.
All the modern technology is applied to library collections, and the availability has now increased to a point where nobody has to wait.
Not too long.
A man spends years in his research problem, 24 hours or 6 hours isn't going to make any difference.
No, not really.
And modern reproductive technology, you could have microfilm or Xerox or whatever you use, copies of almost anything.
And
study at your leisure.
The only trouble is people of my generation and even of the next generation of PhDs after me will not use microfilm, and it's largely because of microfilm industry's failure to provide easy access to using the material. You have to
look into the microfilm's
things.
Easier than taking a trip to another library.
I agree with you, but you can't convince the professors of this. Of course, there's always the value of saying
no problem convincing yourself, did you?
No, because I'm president of the American Microform Academy. I go for it. I mean, I agree with you thoroughly. And it's something that,
person who doesn't want to use microfilm has an important research project is just lazy if he doesn't want to use microfilm.
It's easy to do if you have the equipment. Sometime I'll tell you, do you know the story of British of the Encyclopedia Britannica and its problems?
No.
It's not germane to this, but I'll tell you sometime. It's they almost have a breakthrough going. Excuse me, we got off. Has the legislature been good to you?
Well, through my tenure, I have no complaints.
Would you?
The most severe situation occurred when we were forced to raise the tuition. There are aspects of this that interested me. It was a terrible choice to make. You want to provide the opportunity for education to the students, the vast majority of them, at the lowest possible cost. The choice we had to make was placing the burden of increased cost on the faculty. See, this is what the faculty never recognized. Never said very much about it. When we made the final decision to increase the tuition enough to provide what we didn't get from the legislature to give reasonable salary increases and meet increased needs and demands, we then had the student body and the agitators had the excuse to demonstrate. And interesting. When he made those increases, tuition charges in state and out of state, we also included enough in that increase to increase all the student aid scholarship people by the same amount. In other words, we charged the students enough to pay for those students whom we were helping. And this is the one question that was never asked by anybody.
Why? Well, just didn't know about it, or they didn't want to ask?
The one thing that I decided on is I didn't go to the students for a vote or ask them about it. Because I knew they'd turn it down. They wouldn't vote to spend their money for brother students.
Certainly not.
So that no one suffered in this, except the people who could afford to pay. And they were getting a tremendous bargain at the university anyway.
Wasn't this about the time we heard an awful lot about students' rights?
Well, this was all part and parcel of that particular time. It came in that time period. But we debated this situation internally in the management group hours on end before we finally made our decision. And it was a unanimous decision of all my entire administrative staff to do what we did. We called a meeting to tell the students about it, and there were only two or three hundred that turned up, and there was no reaction at all. And then 6 weeks later, the educators seized on it and caused all the demonstration of trouble, which ended up in the union sit-in. But if I had to do over again, I'd do exactly the same thing.
What else could you do?
Protected the program of the university and its teaching faculty. Protected the students that you were helping, placed an increased financial burden on those families and those students who could afford to pay. But obviously, it was unfair to ask the faculty to observe a certain burden.
Oh, yes. Certainly.
I know over the years, the legislature has been very good to the university system. Of course, in the early years of the development of the regional campus system, it was a bootstrap operation. We acquired sites with the help of alumni in Fort Wayne and Calumet, Hammett, Indianapolis. We operated them as self-supporting enterprises. The only state money that was put in was the little overhead for the central administration here. Finally, the legislature recognized the regional campus system and included it in their appropriations. That was a long, long haul. We used our related corporations and foundations to build our system. They were the financial management vehicles, built our facilities with borrowed money and paid back the borrowed money through rents. The rental of the buildings to the university for the program, and through fees, credit hour fees charged to students included a sum of money to be reserved for the capital structure, the payment of the capital debt.
That's on R.B. Sturt's theory that the university takes part of every dollar and puts it to use to earn money.
Well, not necessarily that theory. The theory was that users at any given period of time help to pay for the total thing over a long 30-year period or more. 40-year period. So 30 or 40 generations of users pay for the building. Now, they cost more because you pay interest all through the years. If you have the capital to invest from the beginning, then you don't pay interest. So when you borrow money to build buildings, you increase their overall cost, but you spread the cost over generations of users. That's what you do with all your self-supporting enterprises, dormitories, unions, athletic facilities. You borrow money and build the facilities, then reserve part of the income to pay off the, amortize the debt and pay the interest. And the faster you amortize the debt and pay the interest from your income, the less the charges. And our whole athletic plan has been built this way through the Ross-Aid Foundation. The athletic plant is rented, football stadium is rented to the university for $1 per year. Then when we enlarge the stadium, the university asks the Ross-Aid Foundation to enlarge the stadium. The Ross-Aid Foundation will borrow the money, enlarge the stadium, and then increase the rent to that amount the university says it can pay until that addition is paid off. So it works very simply.
Very simply.
Once it's paid off, the debt's paid off, then the rent goes back to $1 per year. Because the Ross-Aid Foundation isn't interested in making money. It's only interested in helping the university in the program. No, I have no quarrel with the legislature and the general run of governors. And they've given us a freedom to operate. This freedom was broached when there were increased demands and controls placed on it after you had gone in debt. And we suffered because of IU's failure. We weren't in debt. We managed our affairs. The amount of control was threatened with the formation of the passage of the act establishing the State Board of Regents, State Governing Educational Governing Commission for Higher Education. But the powers of that commission were wisely limited to the assignment of missions, who was to do what in the system, the division of money, which we had done ourselves, and the planning function, because strangely enough in the state there was no one directly authorized by the legislature to do the planning, advanced planning for higher education. So Herman Wells and I did it for 25 years.
Has that changed now? Does Hansen face a new situation?
Well, that's right. Hansen faces a new situation in that he must deal with the State Higher Education Commission. But Hansen still has the right to manage Purdue University and the trustees. But their limitations are on what Purdue can teach, in the sense that they can't undertake teaching programs not approved by the State Commission. And they'll have to manage their program on the amount of money that the State Commission authorizes.
That's only fair.
And they'll have to abide by state plans that are approved. But on that function, on that score, State Higher Commission will do its planning in conjunction with the people from the four state institutions, because there's no one else to work with. Unless you go to the outside and have a hire educational experts and consultants to do the planning for you.
But this is not
this
then.
This
is not then the threat that the Purdue and other state universities will have
well,
to take
you see,
everything
the
they
Stoner
do.
The Stoner Commission. Put in a bill in which they vested the power of administration of the units of the state system in a state higher board of regents, which would have robbed the universities of any control whatsoever. We defeated this in the legislature, substituted our own bill. The present bill was written by Purdue and Indiana, the other two institutions agreeing.
In other words, you still have almost total autonomy.
We have total autonomy within controls, but we always have had this before, since essentially we were controlled by the legislature. And the legislature still controls.
Oh, yes.
as the state commission can only recommend to the legislature. Now, the legislature will not support, will generally not act without recommendations of the state commission in the future, I guess.
And to that extent, the freedom of action has been limited.
You see, Purdue and IU have built up over the years through management, gifts, and trusts, and so on, substantial sums of money devoted to IU and Purdue programs. And to have this taken away after diverted to other purposes is just not acceptable. It was given to Purdue, and it was earned by Purdue, and it should be spent for Purdue programs.
Well, sir, on that note, I've got to get over to a class.
Okay.
Can we, we're just going well, and I'm sorry, but...
It's all right.
This is the end of an interview on July the 11th, 1972.
Something is... Go ahead, finish.
And this is for the Purdue University Archives.